I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Eve Lazarus joins me again. She's got a new book out, Beneath Dark Waters, The Legacy of the Empress of Ireland Shipwreck, and it's a terrific read. What Eve has done is taken a forgotten maritime disaster, one that took more lives than the Titanic, and looked at the narratives in the press of the day that contributed to the sinking's misinterpretation then. She draws on historical documents as well as personal letters and weaves a fascinating tale that brings to life those lives lost as well as survivors, largely thanks to fog in the early hours of the 29th of May 1914, the RMS Empress of Ireland, en route to Liverpool, England, from Quebec City, was rammed by a Norwegian coal ship, Storstad, in the St. Lawrence River. It takes 14 minutes for the Empress of Ireland to sink, and by then only 4 of the 40 lifeboats had been launched. I spoke to Eve earlier this month about the book, how she came to learn of the Empress of Ireland, and the process she undertook to write it. As a fan of Eve's terrific history books, largely on true crime, this new book might be a departure, but it's a dazzling one at that. We're transported to a time of liner travel, a time when myths are created out of various press accounts, as well as how different life was then as now, thanks to technology. Eve Lazarus is a reporter, author, and the host and producer of the Cold Case Canada True Crime podcast. She first appeared on the program 18 years ago and has been on 6 previous times for 6 previous books of hers. All her books seem to be acclaimed and bestsellers. This new one is from Arsenal Pulp Press. She joined me from her home in North Vancouver. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Eve Lazarus. Ms. Lazarus, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to be back.
Yeah. This is, as I was telling you just before we started, just a very fine achievement in terms of the story that you're telling and the research as well. Do you remember when you first, say, heard of the Empress of Ireland?
Yes, I definitely do. I'd had done a talk for a lawyer's 50th birthday in Vancouver about just the stories of old houses. And this lawyer had, one of the lawyers that was attending the presentation, worked for a New York law firm. And he went back to New York and he was telling his boss, Hugh Verrier, the type of research that I did, you know, tracking down long-dead people, descendants and things like that. And he was really interested in the Empress of Ireland. He lived near where it went down in Rimouski in a summer home, mm-hmm. and was Canadian from Montreal. And he'd heard this story that one of the survivors had swum 6 kilometres to shore in the middle of the night after the sinking, and he tried to find out if that, you know, was possible, and he talked to all sorts of people, you know, polar ice swimmers, yeah. marine biologists and everything to try and find out if that was true, and everyone told him it wasn't possible. Anyway, so Hugh hired me to see if I could track down the story of Gordon Davidson, of his actual survival story, whether it was true that it had been in all the newspapers and in books over the last 100-odd years that he'd made this swim to shore, or if it wasn't true, you know, just to set the record straight. And that was the first time I'd heard of the Empress of Ireland. I'd never heard of it before that, and I just wondered, you know, how? Like, I love history. I'm always yeah. reading history. And how could I have not heard of this incredible, you know, disaster that took more passenger lives than the Titanic? And as it turned out, you know, through research, that so many of these lives were from Western Canada, particularly Vancouver.
Yeah, and then it's May 28th, 1914, and I guess the Great War starts when? A couple months after that, right?
Yep, 3 months later.
So, yeah, so you can see how sort of history obscures certain things because of more history, I guess, right?
Well, I guess, you know, it's hard. 3 months later, all these people are trucking off as volunteers and whatever to fight the war and coming home in coffins. So
yeah.
even, you know, with so many people dying in that one event, it's, you know, easily see how that could be eclipsed.
So Hugh Verrier, he had no personal connection or family connection to Gordon Davidson, right?
No. His thing really was because his summer home was near Rimouski, where all of this took place, and he swam in the St. Lawrence River most summers, and so he was always connected to the story and, you know, had various artifacts and things like that from it.
So we'll find out whether the story is true or not, I guess, in the course of reading the book. You start the book though with a story of a voyage involving the captain of the Empress of Ireland. It's another voyage, I guess, an earlier one. Henry George Kendall. It's such a dazzling read, Eve, because on this earlier voyage, on which he was the captain, the story of Dr. Crippen and Miss Leneve, it just seems like an improbable story. Well, it would certainly be an improbable story today, wouldn't it?
Well, I just love this whole chase and everything about it. And, of course, you know, I'm researching the story of the Empress of Ireland thinking, oh, finally I'm getting away from true crime.
Yeah.
And then the first thing I come across is, you know, Captain Kennel's solving this murder mystery. So that was quite delightful, actually, to be able to get that in.
Yeah, so for people listening, just what it is that I guess the doctor was accused of murdering his wife, and then his mistress, they escape, and they're wanted, obviously, or he's wanted, and Captain Kendall spots them on the ship. And so this whole thing's being narrated in the press, but on board, they don't have access to the media of the day. And so
they've just got, they're one of 60 ships in Montrose that Captain Kendall was in charge of that had wireless, you know, this Marconi newfangled wireless. Mm. But it was only good for, I think it was something like 250 miles outside of the port. So he was able to get the telegram off that these two fugitives from justice were on his ship. But he had no idea, you know, whether it even reached, you know, CPR, which owned the ship, or not, but it had, and the Scotland Yard inspector was on this faster boat, and they were racing across the Atlantic, and it was going by real time, and it must have been incredible, you know, from 1910 to be able to read this, and then they finally, you know, caught up in Rimouski, where the Empress goes down 4 years later, and they arrest Captain. They don't arrest the captain. They arrest Dr. Crippen for murder, and Kendall becomes a bit of a hero.
So he's now the captain of the Empress of Ireland, 1914, and this is a regular route, is it, from Quebec to Liverpool and back again?
Yes, it is. It started in 1906. The Empress of Ireland launched then, and with a sister ship called the Empress of Britain, and I can't remember offhand how many trips they made a year, but quite a few, and brought out literally thousands, hundreds of thousands of immigrants to Canada.
Yeah. So it's May 1914 that the sinking of the Titanic was 2 years earlier. This is still something that's on a lot of people's minds. I mean, it factors in how the Empress of Ireland is outfitted in terms of safety and for lifeboats as well, right?
Yeah. It had everything. And it was almost like, you know, everything that could go wrong did in that second. This collier, you know, and the Empress were, the Empress was going towards Rimouski to drop off the river pilot that navigated them down the river, and the collier is coming in from Halifax, and it's picking up a pilot to take it to Montreal, and they both knew this. They could see each other. There was 50 kilometres wide of river, and fog came in, and it completely blotted them out of sight. And they both changed. You know, if they'd done nothing, it would have been fine, but they both changed course. Mm. And the collier hit the Empress in the worst possible spot. It basically was, you know, had an ice prow on it and just carved it through the watertight compartments, so there was no time to sort of close them and keep the ship afloat. And the Empress sank in 14 minutes. Like, to me, that's unbelievable. It's really unbelievable how anyone managed to survive.
Yeah. So I'm going to skip ahead here for just a sec. So when you're looking at, say, the post-mortem of it all, you know, their investigations, obviously, you go to accounts of these investigations and then the, I guess, the inquest, is that what they call it? You see accounts in the Canadian press as well as, say, the Norwegian press. How is it all reported, and how is it all, I mean, you know, journalism's a first draft of history, if you will. How do they, say, talk about what happened and who's to blame and the sort?
Well, it was all, you know, over the headlines. I mean, the world was watching, of course, and they had this huge wreck inquiry that interviewed dozens and dozens of witnesses and heard the testimony and did interview Norwegian crew as well. And they were really, I mean, you know, they were put up there with their broken English and limited interpreters. And so they were really at a disadvantage. They looked at all the evidence and they found reluctantly, they said, that the Storstad captain, who was the second in command, his captain was asleep at the time, and he was neglected to call him when the fog came in, and the blame went onto him. The Empress and Captain Kendall was absolved, but Captain Kendall was also benched very quickly. So I think that sort of said a lot, whether it said, you know, that CPR weren't sure or whether they just thought passengers may not want to travel with a captain that, you know, was in charge of such a disaster. I'm not sure. But the Norwegian had an inquiry as well, the Norwegians, and they found that the Norwegians were not guilty or responsible as well. But the Empress sort of won out on appeal.
Yeah.
But really, when, you know, with everything I've read and looked at, it seems that they weren't really both at fault.
Yeah. The book really comes alive when you tell us the stories of the people who were on board. You mentioned, you know, there was a great contingent of Vancouverites or West Coasters, you know, people from this part of the country. Some recognizable names in Vancouver history, like the Delamont family that, you know, that's memorable. There's a large contingent of Salvation Army members as well. They were going across the Atlantic for a convention or something, is that right?
Yeah, it was the 10th International Congress. So there were about 161, I think it was, Salvation Army members just going on the Empress alone. And there were many more coming from all over the world on different ships and so forth. And but the most of them, the staff band, was on the Empress. And really, the sinking decimated at the Salvation Army in Canada. You know, the top people were killed on the tragedy, and it changed the face of the army.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is because they were all members of the Salvation Army, and they were much missed by you know, people in the organization. I guess there's a lot of memorials and the sort for them, right?
Oh, yeah. I was at one last May. I went back to Rimouski for the 110th anniversary, and a lot of the Salvation Army band members were there as well, and they did an amazing memorial. They've got two memorials in Rimouski. One for the Catholics and one for the non-Catholics.
Mm.
And they did a service and played, you know, a lot of the songs that would have been played on the ship itself. And it was very moving.
I'll bet, yeah. And so in the course of writing this book, you're able to go to places like Rimouski. And 110 years later, they still remember it, don't they?
Yeah. I guess the two groups that have never forgotten is Rimouski, the town of Rimouski, and we went on a bus tour and just looked at all the monuments and street names after it, and it had such a huge impact, and it was a very small French-Canadian town, I think of about 3,000 people in 1914, and they were just so unprepared to deal with such a, you know, incredible accident, and,
yeah,
you know, survivors coming that were had lost family members and were beaten up, and so many dead that they had to put up in mortuaries and makeshift morgues and things like that. And it really has gone on over the century and a bit. And same with the Salvation Army, you know, because it had such a huge impact. They've never forgotten.
Yeah. I mentioned lifeboats earlier in light of the 2 year, 2 years earlier in the sinking of the Titanic. There were enough lifeboats in this on this voyage, but I guess because of was it a time thing that not enough were, say, being able to be deployed?
Yeah, what happened when the Collier hit the Empress? The water just rushed in, and it was within a minute, it had half the ship's weight in water. And it lifted very, very quickly. The power went out. And that was one of the problems. You know, people, if they were able to leave their cabin at all, a lot of them just couldn't make it up the stairs because there was such a lift. Mm. By the time they got to the top deck, they could only release four of the lifeboats. So even while they had, you know, more than enough for everybody, only four could be released. And even with the life jackets that they had, they were all in the cabins, and people left so quickly that they, you know, a lot of them just forgot to grab them. Mm. You know, they didn't know what was going on, and, you know, they were obviously frightened, couldn't see in the dark. And so a lot of the deaths were attributed to people just being in the water and not being, you know, able to swim.
And again, stories of heroism and sacrifice are throughout the book. Is there a person whose heroism has stayed with you over the course of, say, writing Beneath Dark Waters?
Yeah, and that would be the ship's doctor, Dr. James Grant. Mm. He was 26 years old. He was from Victoria, BC, and he was just amazing. It was only his second time as a ship's doctor. He'd just graduated from McGill, so he was new at all that. Mm-hmm. He was quite injured. He'd got out through a porthole, which is just when you see how tiny the portholes are, it's unbelievable, and he'd hurt his shoulder, and he'd ended up having to swim most of the way to the Storstad in the freezing cold with injuries and managed to survive where many didn't. And as soon as he got on board, he demanded someone give him some clothes because he was naked and said, "I'm the ship's doctor," and he went to work. And he just saved so many lives and did that on the Collier. And then when they were transported to Rimouski, he stayed with them. He stayed, you know, treated them when they, because there were so few doctors when they got to Rimouski. You know, he was going around for the next 24 hours, and he was just incredible.
The thing that I found just so delightful as I was reading your book was the work of the researcher comes through. You can see how you mine the local press of the day and you know, all the sources that you seek, as well as contacts that you make in the present with say descendants of victims and people who were on this voyage. I've asked you this before, Eve, but I'm just specifically with this book. Did you find the research for this book fun?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. It was such a challenge finding the descendants. Like, I had coffee on Sunday with John Langley's grandson. He was a survivor from Merritt. And he turns out he lives about 10 minutes away from me. So we sort of met up for the first time. And he hadn't met his grandfather, but his father had all sorts of stories. And he and his family had grown up, you know, with these, you know, stories of the Empress of Ireland. And just yesterday, I got a call from another granddaughter. Tragically, she'd lost her grandmother and her aunt and uncle, who were babies, on the Empress. And her father was 8 at the time, and he'd stayed behind with his father and so survived. But, you know, the whole family was basically wiped out on this Empress of Ireland. And I tried to get it for the book and hadn't been able to reach her, and heard yesterday that I was doing it and contacted me. So that was great. So I'll be doing all these blogs as people hopefully turn up, you know, and carrying their stories forward.
Yeah, you do tell some stories in the book about how for the survivors, it affects their family a great deal, doesn't it?
Oh, decades. You know, we've got generations later, and it's still affected them. And, you know, I was talking to this woman yesterday, and she said, you know, she was a teacher, and she spent a lot of time trying to tell the story of the Empress of Ireland and get it out, and how frustrating it was for her in London, Ontario, that no one seemed interested. Mm. You know, the Titanic was so huge, yet here's this incredible Canadian story that affected so many people in 8 provinces that just has been largely ignored. So it's been a real privilege to me to sort of find these stories and tell them, especially the human interest stories of the people and really what happened to them after they survived the Empress.
The other thing that also I found fascinating was that, unlike the Titanic, where it's, you know, there were a lot of, say, wealthy people, you know, the sort of 1% of today aboard, this ship had the Empress of Ireland was able to have a good cross-section of society, right? I mean, it did have wealthy people, I suppose, but it had, for lack of a better word, you know, ordinary, regular people, right?
Well, most of the people were. Yeah. They were in second class, Salvation Army, mm-hmm. and if you like Gordon Davidson, that he was doing his PhD, and in third class, had the most. There were over 700 people, and they were the ones that mostly died, because they were on the bottom of the ship,
yeah.
and it was incredibly hard for them to get out. But yeah, first class was made up of only 87 passengers, and there were very few, you know, sort of really wealthy people like the Titanic would have been. There, a couple of British actors that were quite famous at the time, Laurence Irving and his wife, and they both died, and a few, you know, quite wealthy Quebecers and from Toronto. But yeah, largely were just ordinary Canadians or immigrants.
There are a lot of great photographs in the book, and I can't help but think it was a hard decision in terms of what to decide as to what to include. I mean, the book could have been twice the size with all the photographs, say, that you had.
Yeah, it was. I think sourcing the photos took almost as much time as writing the book, and just sort of tracking down, you know, people that relatives and archives and things like that, and trying to get information and photos that hadn't been seen before. So that was a lot of fun. I was talking about having coffee with one of the grandsons last week. He'd been able to supply me a lot of photos of his grandfather, and even the pajamas that he'd worn, that he escaped in, had been kept in the family for, generations, dozens of years, and were finally donated to a museum in Gatineau. And so that was great, just having those sorts of photos, and people sent me, you know, the grandfather's stopwatch that had stopped the second that they'd hit the water, and,
wow.
you know, family heirlooms like that. So that was a big thrill to be able to put those in the book.
There's one moment in the book that you describe that I think says a lot about the work that you've done over the years, and it's the story of you found a post from a survivor's relative. But it was from over 10 years ago, or maybe 10 years ago or so.
20 years, yeah.
Yeah, or something like that. And then there was an email address.
Yep.
And, you know, you email it cold, hoping that you'll get a response. I can't help but think that a lot of your work is like that, where you don't get a response, and maybe half the time you do, right?
Well, it was funny. I was talking about this granddaughter that contacted me yesterday.
Yeah.
I'd been trying to find her, and I didn't even know she was alive. She had a fairly common surname.
Right, right.
But I must have called, you know, a couple of dozen of those surnames leaving messages. You know,
yeah.
You are the relative that had, you know, a relative on the Empress of Ireland. Could you please get in touch with me? And, excuse me. And when I talked to her yesterday, I found out she wasn't one of the ones I called.
Wow.
So all these people have got messages wondering, you know, who is this strange woman from Vancouver?
But that's what makes the work exciting and so worthwhile, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And with this one you were talking about, it was a message board from about 20 years ago. And it just talked about she had her grandfather on the Empress of Ireland. And that's what I did. I sort of crossed my fingers and fired off an email. And then she phoned me from Ireland a day or so later. And she was a nun and had lived with her grandfather until she was 18. And so she had a personal connection, which, of course, you know, it's really hard with all that time that's gone by. And so that was just a huge thrill to be able to talk to her and tell her story.
Yeah, it's another great story that's in the book that, as a reader, you do, there's that moment of excitement as a reader that, you know, you hope Eve gets in contact, and then when she does, it's a great payoff, obviously. I seem to ask you this all the time we talk as to what you're working on next. You're probably working on another book now, are you?
I'm not, actually. I'm taking a bit of a break. I'm doing the podcast, mm-hmm. the True Crime Podcast. And so I'm having a lot of fun with that and just doing some teaching and publicity starts for the book soon. It's not actually out in the bookstores until April 29th.
Yeah.
So that's a bit strange, having a book that's actually completed, you know, and out, but not really out in the world.
I love the podcast, I have to say, and I know a lot of people listen to it.
Thank you.
Because they're readers of yours, fans of the book. And I remember one friend told me, actually two friends told me this. They said until they heard the book, until they heard the podcast, because they'd read your books over the years, they didn't know you had an accent.
Well, one of the funny things is with this book, it's been made into an audio book. It's the first time that's ever happened. And
yeah.
It's so weird listening to the sample because it's this woman with this really strong New York accent doing my voice, you know, in my voice, and it's kind of like, oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. It is a very fine achievement, Eve. I'm so very happy for you that it's out. Will be out shortly. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it. I can't help but think that it'll be a big success like all the other books.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe, and thanks for having me on. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
The book is called Beneath Dark Waters, The Legacy of the Empress of Ireland Shipwreck. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Its author, Eve Lazarus, joined me on the line from North Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.